From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nigut. Donald Trump becomes the first former president to sit for a criminal trial today. He's in a Manhattan courtroom where he's being tried for 34 felony counts in the Stormy Daniels hush money case. What might this mean in the Georgia criminal case?
I'm Tia Mitchell in Washington. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson says that in response to Iran's attack on Israel, the House will take up a military assistance bill for Israel. But it remains to be seen whether it will win support as a standalone bill or whether it will be tied to demands for border security and money for Ukraine.
Plus, Tia tells us how Georgia Congressman Mike Collins has used social media for good and ill to become one of the highest profile freshman Republicans in the U.S. House. We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents...
Hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny...
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
Welcome to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Politically Georgia, where we aim to set the stakes and the agenda for Georgia politics. I'm Bill Nigut, joined by co-host Tia Mitchell, who, of course, is in Washington, the Washington correspondent for the AJC. And Tia, before we introduce our guests, welcome back. You've had a couple of weeks to rest up, relax a little bit. You've been to wonderful locations across Europe. It must be have given you great memories, but are you glad to be back at work?
I am definitely glad to be back. I definitely enjoyed my trip. The only thing is I'm waiting for my cell phone to get back because it got left behind in Paris.
Oh, no. Well, you know, Paris is a great place to be stuck. So maybe your cell phone just doesn't want to come home. I hope you get it back soon, Tia.
Yeah.
We have a lot to talk about on the show today. Some important national news. It also relates to Georgia, international news with a Georgia angle as well. And a little later, Tia, you wrote a terrific profile of Congressman Mike Collins that appeared in the paper over the weekend. We'll talk a bit about what you learned about him. So let's get right to introducing our guests and begin the conversation. We're joined today by our good friend Michael Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today. How are things going out in DeKalb?
Things are well. Of course, we're in the midst of a campaign season, which I'm not a part of.
Yeah.
It's quite a joy right now.
Yeah. My daughter the other day said, is Michael Thurman running for re-election? I said, no, his time as CEO is about to expire. Are you happy about that?
Shed no tears for me.
Oh. Eric Tannenblatt is back with us as well. Eric's a longtime insider in Georgia and national Republican politics, worked early on with Paul Coverdale, worked with the Bush family, George H.W., George W. Bush, was a major player in raising money for Jeb Bush way back in 2016, Mitt Romney, chief of staff in the first term of Sonny Perdue. We could go on for a long time, Eric, enlisting your participation in politics. How are you today?
I'm doing great and glad to be here with my friend Michael, and great to be with Kerwin as well. And always good to be with you, Bill and Tia.
Kerwin is Kerwin Swint, who is the director of the School of Government and International Affairs at Kennesaw State University and has taught political science up there for quite some time. How are you, Kerwin? How long have you been at KSU now?
You know, it's crazy. This is my 31st year at Kennesaw State. I can't believe it.
Okay. Ooh. Well, thank you very much, all of you, for being here today. All right, let's get right to it. In a Manhattan courtroom right now, jury selection should be getting underway. Donald Trump is there. Once again, he makes history. He's the first president or former president of the United States to sit for a criminal trial. He's charged with 34 counts, felony counts in the hush money trial, hush money case. And of course, the allegations are that through his then attorney, Michael Cohen, Michael Cohen fronted about $130,000 in hush money payments to Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election to keep her from speaking out about her alleged affair with Donald Trump. When Trump paid back the money to Michael Cohen, the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, says he did it illegally by trying to cover up what the payments were actually for. So, Tia, just as a starting point, again, history. We have never seen a president of the United States charged and sitting in a courtroom with felony offenses.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, the charges are one thing, and the substance of the charges and what could come out in the course of this trial is, you know, the practical matter. But just from a historic standpoint, exactly what you said, this is a former president. That's never happened before. And I think that we just take for granted there are so many unusual things about Donald Trump and his presidency. But, it, you know, pre-Trump, it would have been unheard of to think that a president who we hold to such high esteem would be accused of the things that Donald Trump stands accused of. And could you imagine a Ronald Reagan or a Jimmy Carter having to sit in a courtroom?
Yeah, well, that's exactly where I want to go with this. On Friday, many of you listened to the show, and if you didn't, it's available on a podcast. Former District Attorney Bob Wilson of DeKalb County spent a lot of time talking with us about the legal aspects of the case. We can do some of that today, but I really want to talk about the politics of all this. And Eric Tannenblatt, I pick up on what Tia Mitchell just said. You have worked with some of the most significant Republicans in public life throughout your career. So when you see what's happening to Donald Trump, your reaction?
Well, I would never have thought that I would see this day. But then again, I never thought that I would see someone like Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a very unique political and historical figure. And, you know, with regards to today's case, you know, there are four cases, as everyone knows, against the former president. This one, by, I guess, many opinions, is the weakest of them all. And starting out with this case, I think, plays right into the narrative that Donald Trump has been promoting. Whether it's true or not, is that this is all political and politically motivated. And even when he walked into the courthouse about 30 minutes ago, he made some opening statement and talked about how this is all about politics and even tied it to the current president who he's running against in the upcoming election. So I'm not sure that the substance of this is going to get as much attention just because this is Donald Trump has very effectively turned this into more of a political matter.
Kerwin, there are people who, regardless of their personal like or dislike for Donald Trump, have said for a democracy to come to the point where it puts a former president on trial in the middle of an election year is something we should all look at with a certain amount of serious concern.
Yeah, I mean, it's a historic development, as Tia was saying. We've never been here before, never anywhere close to this kind of situation before. And I sort of agree with what Eric was saying in that if you look at these four cases, they're all brought right before a presidential election. It begins to look and smell a little bit like political persecution. And I think that's one reason that Donald Trump has done well in the polls over the last year. I'm not even sure at this point that a conviction in the New York case would hurt him in the polls very much. I just don't think it's going to have that kind of impact. The federal cases might be different, but the New York case and even the Georgia case, I just don't think independent voters, for example, are going to attach much importance to it.
So, Mike, I want to get you involved immediately on this. I think many people agree with what Eric and Kirkwood said, particularly about the hush money trial. But, Mike, the charges against him in Georgia for attempting to overturn the election is certainly a factual as well as a legal case. Now, whether the fact can be proven to a jury or not, we don't know. And the federal cases for violations of the national security act, not turning over documents that should never have been in his possession after he left office. These are fact-based cases. It's not. I think you can take move away from politics and look at what the facts of those cases are.
I'm not so certain you can do that. Actually, I have to agree with Professor Swint. Donald Trump, like him or not, look, I'm supporting Joe Biden, full disclosure, totally. But he has a unique ability to turn these trials into political platforms, even a political circus. There's not anyone that I know, really, just to be honest, who will think that regardless of the outcome of either in Georgia or New York, that this is going to impact his base, the MAGA base. There is some question as to how much or if it might impact independent voters. And so that's what's really at play. But Trump has demonstrated in the past that he can take these trials. He can become the ultimate martyr. The fact that it's in New York is all he needs. And to with his base in other parts of the country to say that, look, it's politicized and I'm just being targeted because I'm here fighting for you. That doesn't resonate with people like me, but he's not talking to people like me. He's trying to, number one, fire up his base and hopefully influence independent voters if they've not yet made up their mind.
Tia, jump in.
So I was going to ask about the trial. You know, it's so kind of ironic. We just lost O.J. Simpson, and all of us, I think, are old enough to remember that. Remember the wall-to-wall coverage. I was in school. Why did we watch the verdict in school? I don't know, but we did. Do you think the 24-hour news cycle, that was the beginning of it? That was the, you know, that was seen as one of the first examples of that. How do you think the coverage of this trial, we talk about public opinion, but we're so desensitized to Trump, but now there is going to be wall-to-wall coverage. Do you think people are paying attention? I want to start with Professor Swint. Do you think people are going to be paying attention? Will this wall-to-wall coverage have eyes on it in ways that could either strengthen Trump's support or cause people to maybe hear things that question it?
Kirkwood?
Yeah, I think it's going to be highly watched, highly followed by everyone because it's the potential next president of the United States. It's just a crying shame that it's not going to be televised like the O.J. Simpson case was. New York doesn't allow cameras. But yeah, this is a historic case. It has all kinds of implications. You know, Trump, of course, is tailor-made for a situation like this, as Mike was saying.
Eric, you have never been a fan of Donald Trump's. You obviously were very involved in the primaries, and you had a candidate who you thought was going to be a particularly good challenger to Donald Trump, but nobody was able to come close to taking on Donald Trump in the primary season. So with the trials beginning today, what do you see as what What is the Republican Party today, Eric?
Well, I think in terms of the trial and to Tia's point about the coverage, I think Fox News is going to continue to play the narrative that Donald Trump's the victim. And I think MSNBC and CNN are going to, talk about how horrible it is, what he did. And so people are going to hear what they want to hear. They're going to listen to what they want to listen to. And so in terms of the Republican base, I don't think that it's going to move the needle much at all. And I think in terms of the people that may not have supported President Trump or former President Trump in the primary, I think issues are going to play a bigger issue in where they end up going during this election.
Well,
and we've got some pretty big issues facing the country right now.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think I'm asking, thank you for that, but I'm asking, I think, a larger question. You had hoped that the future of the Republican Party might look more like Nikki Haley than Donald Trump. That is not what happened. So, yes, we have a trial right now. But if Trump is convicted in this trial, forget about whether he's convicted or whether he's found not guilty. What does the face of the Republican Party look like right now?
Well, Donald Trump. I mean, he clearly beat all the other candidates in the primary. So he's the titular head of the primary. He's the presumptive nominee of the party. I mean, if some of your listeners may have seen Chris Sununu on This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday, where, Chris Sununu, Governor Sununu from New Hampshire, was a big Nikki Haley supporter, and he's now thrown his support behind President Trump. And he said 51% of the voters are for President Trump. Now, that doesn't mean that, he likes the options that we have in front of us. But at the end of the day, if it's an election between former President Trump and President Biden, I think, Republicans are going to line up behind President Trump.
Tia?
So let's go back to that. The fact that, and I want to stay with you, Eric, so many Republicans see these trials not just as persecution of Donald Trump, but Donald Trump has told them these trials are you. They are taking your rights away. This is about them keeping you from having the person you want as the leader. He's really done a great messaging job making people feel personally attacked by these trials that have no impact on their personal lives, but they believe they do. Can you talk about that phenomenon? And can you talk about how that will play out?
Yeah, I almost look at it as the 2016 election, where Donald Trump became this vessel for all these people that felt disenfranchised. And they all gravitated towards him because he became their voice, looking out for them. And he's doing the same thing now with the trials. And he's talking about, how our justice system isn't fair. And he's painting himself as the victim. And, he never uses the word I. He talks about Trump. People don't like Trump. And so he's created this movement. And I think the base of the party is following that movement. Now, that doesn't mean every single Republican falls into that category. But as I said before, I think those that may not fall into that category may end up moving towards Trump because of issues and because of President Biden's record.
Mike, many Democrats have said what in fact Nikki Haley, the Republican candidate, said during the primary season, which is that they don't want to rely on a guilty verdict in whatever cases are adjudicated before the general election. And it's conceivable this might be the only one. They don't want to see a guilty verdict be the reason that Donald Trump fails to win the White House. They think it needs to be in the hands of the voters of this country. How do you look at that?
Well, I believe that Joe Biden will be reelected in November by what would be a substantial margin based on recent history of presidential elections. What I did say, the base, the MAGA base is not enough to win the race in November. What I also recognize is that there will be other issues, whether it's reproductive rights for women that's going to impact the outcome of this race. Trump himself is concerned, and if you really listen to him, and I know that might be difficult for Democrats, but just listen, he's trying more now to be more like a traditional politician. I don't think that's going to play well for him going forward, because what made him the politician he is was he was the unpolitician. But he is now, if you listen, his issue about it's up to the states in terms of abortion and abortion rights. These are issues, and he's trying to play both ends to the middle. I just think that's not going to play well for him. He'll continue to beat the drum of being a martyr, but those things don't play well in the long run. He will keep his base. I don't think there's any power to remove those who truly support and believe in him. I just don't think it's enough to be successful in November.
Mike, and then Kerwin, if I could, I'd love for you to weigh in on the new New York Times Siena poll, which had interesting results. First of all, it showed that Joe Biden has virtually closed the gap with Donald Trump. He'd been leading in the New York Times Siena poll by a number of points. It's virtually a tie right now, but that's nationally. That has nothing to do with how individual states are going to vote, swing states like Georgia. But I think more interesting, Mike, is their finding that people were asked, thinking back to when Donald Trump was president, what do you remember most about the presidency? 34% said they have a negative assessment of that time, but an equal number said a positive sentiment, while 26% said they don't have a positive or a negative response. And Mike, a lot of this kind of supports this notion that there's a certain amount of, quote, Trump amnesia in terms of what people don't remember about the turmoil of the Trump presidency.
One of the things I think we need to consider is that we live in a world that is so highly politicized right now, is that people aren't necessarily supporting or opposing candidates as they are supporting or opposing positions. Donald Trump and or Joe Biden, President Biden, represent a group of voters or a group of people who have two very different worldviews. And so we tend to be nostalgic about the past. That's just who we are. It's human nature. And I suspect that 3 or 4 years from now, Bill Nigel, you DeKalb County residents will look back and wax eloquently about the great days when Michael Thurman was CEO. You know, not so much today, but I just think in 3 or 4 years, you might be able to say that. So that's just the nature of the game and the beast and the landscape in which politics is played.
Kerwin?
That's probably true. You know, sometimes things look better in hindsight. And I think people look at the problems that the country is having right now, and Trump may look better by comparison. But the New York Times Siena College poll you cited was interesting, Bill. I mean, it shows that yes, nationally, Trump and Biden are pretty much tied, and it will be the swing states that tells the tale and all that. But that poll also has some bad news for Joe Biden if you look at where the voters come down on policies.
Yes.
And so that's for an incumbent president, he's got some vulnerabilities there.
Tia, one of the strangest numbers in that poll for me, or one of the things that stood out, was when asked what you remember about Trump's presidency in terms of issues, only 4% mentioned the coronavirus pandemic, which so many people would suggest in the time that they were living it was a period of incredible chaos at the White House.
Yeah, and I think to me that also translates to when you listen to what Trump says now, he's projecting a chaotic second term if he is to be elected back into the presidency. And I'm not saying that's a good or a bad thing, but that's, if you listen to what he's saying, he's talking about things that, you know, it makes me wonder, are people not listening? Do they not believe him? Is it we are desensitized because he does talk in ways that are so unorthodox for most past presidents and candidates for the presidency? What do you guys think? Like, it's, you know, I just wonder when you, if you were to just say some of the things he said, again, historically, it would be seen as not only disqualifying, but you would say someone who says these things would never even be considered. It wouldn't be possible for them to possibly be president. But here we are with a very unorthodox candidate in Donald Trump.
We're going to have to get to a break fairly soon. So Eric and Kerwin, I'm going to give you a chance to answer that one. Eric?
Yeah. So, you know, I would say this, that, you know, elections are a referendum on the incumbent. And even though Donald Trump was president 4 years, Joe Biden is the incumbent. And so there's distance from the Trump presidency, and people do have short memories. And what Joe Biden is doing today is impacting people's everyday lives. So whether it's inflation, whether it's the border, whether it's what's happening in the Middle East and how he's responding to that, I think all of that is impacting how people view President Biden. And with regards to the polls closing, this New York Times Siena poll, and I'm glad you pointed out, Bill, that this was a national poll, not on the battleground states. I think one of the reasons why they consolidated is that Donald Trump became the presumptive nominee, and he's probably a great unifier for the Democratic Party. But when you look at the broader electorate, again, I go back, this is a referendum on Joe Biden. And one issue that hasn't come up that we cannot forget is Joe Biden is old. And I know Donald Trump is old, too, but Joe Biden looks and acts old. I mean, even when you saw him walking into the Oval Office on Saturday when the Iranian attack hit Israel, he was, strolling into the office. He looked like an old man. And I think that is a real problem for voters.
Kerwin, did we give you a last word on this?
Yeah, well, Donald Trump has an undeniable appeal. You know, we live in strange times. We really do. And Donald Trump has found a way. He's found some kind of magic formula to just be very real and say things that, you know, a former presidential candidate would never say or get away with. And he makes them seem almost normal. And I think a lot of that is baked into the cake about Donald Trump.
All right. Well, we're going to watch all this. The trial, again, jury selection began today. 500 jurors called in. Now, they're not all there for the Trump trial. The Manhattan courts will also have other trials getting underway. But 100 people at a time are going to be brought in to the courtroom to begin answering questions. They think the jury selection process could take a week or more, trying to find people who say they can be objective, despite strong feelings one way or the other, in many cases of Donald Trump. So we're going to watch how it all unfolds, as all of you are out there as well. We got to get to a break. We'll be back with more on Politically Georgia in just a moment.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm Bill Nygut, along with our co-host Tia Mitchell in Washington. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from the AJC politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters and sign up today. That's ajc.com/newsletters. I'm Bill Nygut, along with co-host Tia Mitchell in Washington, Kerwin Swint from Kennesaw State, Republican Eric Tannenblatt, and DeKalb County Democrat and CEO of the county, Michael Thurman. Michael, very quickly, I didn't mention your book. You've got a book out. Tell us about it quickly, please.
Please. Thank you. James Oglethorpe, Father of Georgia. Founder's Journey from Slave Trader to Abolitionist, I think hopefully people will read it and learn more about the amazing gentleman who founded Georgia and was among the first white men in North America to oppose chattel slavery.
All right. Well, we appreciate your coming on the show, so we do feel like we ought to give you a chance to mention your book, which you worked on for any number of years. I want to do a quick plug, too. You know, Thursday evening, we're going to be out in Athens doing a roadshow edition of Politically Georgia. Patricia, Greg, Tia and I, Tia's coming in from Washington. We'll be out there. If you want to join us, just go to live.ajc.com, which is an events page for the AJC, and you'll find our event on that page. You can sign up and join us out in Athens. All right, let's move on with this great group of guests for today's show. Tia, I think the world was shocked by Iran launching a direct attack on Israel, an unprecedented military action between two powers, which have, for the most part, fought through surrogates. And now it has come to direct attack by Iran. And, of course, the political reaction to this has divided people again, in some cases, among our elected officials on party lines. The morning AJC Politically Georgia newsletter points out that there's been some squabbling between Jason Anavatarte, a Republican who wanted to make sure that the people in Georgia knew that the Senate had passed a resolution supporting Israel in this time of difficulty. Meanwhile, Representative Rua Roman, the only Palestinian American in the legislature, thought it was a somewhat cynical statement, given she feels the way that Israel has been attacking Gaza Strip, at killing civilians, allowing hunger to go unaddressed in some cases. So there's that fight, Tia, and then we're going to see a fight over funding for Israel in the U.S. House. Start us off on this part of the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's, number one, important to note that the attack on Israel from Iran is a retaliatory attack because the Iranian consulate in Syria was hit by an airstrike 2 weeks ago. It killed several senior Iranian military officers, and Iran blamed Israel for that attack. So for days, the U.S. was telling Israel, you know, our intelligence is telling us that Iran is going to retaliate. And that's what happened. In the grand scheme of things, the retaliation was unprecedented and pretty large scale, but in actual impact, it seems to be pretty minor. No casualties were reported. A lot of the missiles were either intercepted or downed. But you talked about how so many politicians from both sides of the aisle, but particularly Republicans, were so swift to like back Israel. And yes, there are politics in play, but to me, I also see it as a relic of a much different time. That willingness to kind of speak up for Israel, to, you know, make sure that you confirm that Israel's like a ally and we protect Israel at all costs, is something that politicians still defer to. But I think in today's political climate, it doesn't have the same type of impact with the way that people, a lot of younger voters, are more skeptical of Israel and its policies in the Middle East. So to me, it just shows that generational divide, not just a political divide.
Mike Thurmond, you know, we've talked on this show a lot about the fact that President Biden's really had to walk a tightrope on the Israeli war against Hamas because although Israel is such a powerful ally of and has been historically of Israel in the Middle East, because of the what many people see as the merciless attacks on Gaza, obviously Biden is also having to placate to some extent people who are now increasingly upset with the way the war is being fought. So here's the question at the end of all that. Does this change that equation to some extent for President Biden? Does it give him a reasonable way to really show his support for Israel? And will those critics of Israel's policies be a little less inclined to attack him, or no?
Tough question. Yes to the really the first part of your first question that you asked, for a doddering old man, Eric, I think President Biden is doing a phenomenal job using the experience that he's been able to bring to fore at a very critical time as this. One of the things that Ms. Tia Mitchell mentioned, I think is important, that the retaliation was phased. One of the military experts pointed out that the rockets were launched in a way not to overwhelm the defenses that Israel and its allies had. They were launched in phases, which made it, I don't want to use the word easier, but increased the probability that they could be intercepted. So this is a very volatile situation. I think President Biden played it well, and the Democrats, by voicing their support. Israel has been our strongest and most complete ally in the Middle East. You can't create any daylight there. But to the second part, I think this does create an opportunity for Biden, President Biden, to continue to try to maintain some stability in this very volatile region. It takes focus away from the offensive in Gaza and shifts it back to Iran. Iran doesn't have as many supporters in the United States as the Palestinian does. And I don't think you're going to see large demonstrations in support of Iran and Israel's response to their attack.
Kerwin, international affairs is in your remit at KSU. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it seems to me that Republicans have, for a long time, been all in on Israel. And that's a reliable position for Republicans in general. The Democrats have it a little bit tougher because they have historically supported Israel as well, yet they have a large segment of Democratic Party voters who support the Palestinian cause. And so it's been much more of a balancing act for Democrats. And now Joe Biden in particular, he's in a tough spot. I think the attack on Israel does make it a little bit easier for Joe Biden to support Israel, but it's by no means going to be easier for him between now and November,
Eric,
especially in a state like Michigan.
Eric?
Yeah, I agree with Kerwin, and I do, Michael, to your point, this is an opportunity for President Biden to really show his strength in leadership. And we'll see what happens. Now, I do want to take some exception. You mentioned the retaliatory attack to what happened in Syria. Well, that was not in Iran. Okay, the what happened over the weekend was in Israel, and you know you could say that was a retaliatory attack. There's been proxies of Iran that have been shooting things, whether it's Hezbollah, and let's not forget what happened October 7th. The proxies, Hamas, attacked Israel again in their country. So I think the Republicans are continuing to take their unified position. I totally agree with what Kerwin said. I think that this is a problem inside the Democratic Party. And, you know, you have, you know, I think it was Tia, you raised the issue of younger voters and, you know, younger voters who, you know, the Democrats count on. Really have some real concerns about what's going on in Gaza. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in Congress this week when, you know, they're going to have to address the issue of aid to Israel. And you can't, you know, lose sight of the fact that Ukraine's in there, too, and they're sort of tied together.
Tia, jump in on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think to Eric's point, that's what the younger people are saying. It didn't start on October 7th either. So I think it's more complicated than just for a lot of younger voters. Their perspective is it's not just about Israel being a victim all the time. And I'm not saying they're right or they're wrong, but when you talk to a lot of younger voters, they reject the narrative that Israel is always on the defense or always that it's only just retaliating when it's attacked. They see Israel as more of an aggressor from, again, not just it starting on October 7th. And I think that's why the whole complication, the whole conversation has become more complicated.
Tia, we'll thank you for that. We'll have a chance to talk more about what's going to happen on the Hill this week, but I think you should at least give us a little bit before we have to get to a final break of the show. The Speaker, Mike Johnson, says he will take up an aid for Israel bill. The Senate had a $95 billion package, which they passed on to the House for military aid for Ukraine and Israel. The House has sat on that. It's been stalled. Members like Marjorie Taylor Greene have no interest, particularly in funding Ukraine. And yet this week, they're going to have to make some hard decisions on where they stand on all this, Tia.
Yeah, and it's a really hard decision because there is a bill that the House could pass today very easily that the Senate already passed, and it could go straight to President Biden. It would have money for Israel, also some money for Ukraine and Taiwan, and a little bit of border security. But we know that bill is very problematic for Speaker Johnson. That's a bill that Marjorie Taylor Greene has said that if he brings it to the floor, she will try to remove him as Speaker. But then you say, well, they can just do standalone Israel funding. Because, again, Israel was attacked recently. There's a lot of support for Israel. Israel funding could pass, but then it would have problems over in the Senate. And it would be problematic for a lot of Democrats. Because, again, they don't believe that there should be money for Israel without humanitarian aid for Gaza, without some stipulations on making sure that Israel doesn't use the money to do things that some Democrats would find problematic. So no easy answers.
I want to get a quick response from each of you, but before we have to get to a break. Herwin, start with you. This is a dilemma for the House. I think more on the Republican side than the Democratic side of the aisle. Nevertheless, there are people like Marjorie Taylor Greene who don't want to give aid to Ukraine and aren't that excited about giving it to Israel either, for that matter.
Yeah, Mike Johnson's really on a knife's edge. I think he has the second toughest job in the world after Joe Biden. But I do think he's a little bit clever in trying to force a vote on Israel-only aid and get Democrats on the record, yes or no, support for Israel. Don't know if it'll work.
Eric?
Yeah, I agree with Kerwin. I think that Speaker Johnson is pretty clever, but I think at some point enough is enough with Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I think President Trump's comments when he was standing with Speaker Johnson on Friday was as subtle a way that President Trump can send a signal to her that, you know, I'm standing with the speaker. But, you know, we're talking about an international crisis going on in the world right now. And this is not time for grandstanding and for blowhards to try and, you know, stifle the process. We got to address these issues.
Mike, Eric makes a good point. President Trump says he thinks Mike Johnson is doing a great job, and he knows that Marjorie Taylor Greene really respects the speaker. Mike?
Well, something else Eric just said that's so critical. We're sitting literally on a powder keg. Combatants who either have access to nuclear weapons, not just in Israel and Gaza and the Ukraine. And for Republicans to resist and not acknowledge the importance of maintaining a Ukrainian democracy, of defending Russian aggression, is just almost inconceivable to me for them to even try to differentiate between Israel and the brave Ukrainian people who are fighting to protect their democracy and their liberty from this aggression.
All right.
I just don't think that's going to play out well in the long run.
Mike Thurman, you get the final word today's second segment of the show. And I've got to also thank you all for being here. Michael Thurman, Kerwin Swint, and Eric Tannenblatt. Really a pleasure to have you on a very big, important news day. So thank you for joining us. We're going to take a break and come back. Tia Mitchell's going to talk a little bit about a profile she did on one of the most interesting members of the Georgia House delegation. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.
Tia Mitchell, you have written a series of really wonderful profiles of members of Georgia's congressional delegation, House and Senate, and I always enjoy reading them. We have very little time today, but you've got a brand new profile of Mike Collins, freshman member of the House, and a guy who's attracted a lot of attention on X.
Yeah, and it was interesting to write about him because on one hand, he wants to be more of a traditional member of Congress. He loves to celebrate the fact that he's had a bill signed into law. He was the first freshman to have a bill signed into law, which means he had to work with Democrats, work with the Senate, work with the White House. But as you all, our readers, might have heard us talk about him in the past, during the speaker's race, he kind of became a social media phenomenon going viral. But those posts have kind of become a little bit more darker, more cynical, more problematic for a lot of people over the recent months. So he's gone somewhat MAGA on social media. And for some people, that's a contrast, left them wondering, you know, who is this guy really? So we try to dig into that in the profile.
One of the things that I think is really fascinating about your profile is our listeners may not know his dad was a member of the U.S. House, Mac Collins. I covered Mac when I was still working at Channel 2 News. And you point out the differences between his dad and Mike, the different environment that they legislate in.
Yes, very much. So, and Representative Collins is very sensitive to the comparisons, quite frankly. He's sensitive to the fact, you know, when he was running against Vernon Jones said, your dad used to be a Democrat and, you know, almost try to paint his dad as a rhino, which isn't the case.
Yeah.
He's an old school blue dog Democrat that became a Republican like many other Republicans of that generation during a kind of a shift in the political climate. His dad was conservative, but his dad also would work across the aisle. He had very powerful committee positions. He definitely is that old conservatism that, you know, in a lot of ways, Trump has moved the party further to the right, leaving a lot of those conservatives behind. So who knows what kind of politician Mac Collins would be if he were around in 2024.
Yes. Real quickly, I want to point out that, you know, we were all in Washington with you last month and met with a number of members of Congress at a big dinner that you were a big part of. And Mike Collins, we talked with when he came to an event we hosted the next day. He is the one member of Congress who sent me a personal handwritten note thanking me, saying how nice it was to meet with. Those are the touches that matter a lot with your constituents. And even to a journalist.
Yeah, and he's great at retail politics. When I was shadowing him, he spoke to a Rotary Club meeting. He did some signings of a young man who's going to a military academy. Very traditional offline.
Tia Mitchell, people should read it at AJC.com, your terrific profile of U.S. Congressman Mike Collins. We're out of time, Tia, for today's podcast. You can hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta. Or do what you're doing right now. Follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I'm Ernie Suggs, race and culture reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
And I'm Ned Ravone, lifestyle columnist. Atlanta has been known as the Black Mecca for so many years, but that means something different to everybody.
It means everything to me. I've been living here for 24 years, and I am still amazed at how rich the city's Black culture continues to grow. Every day I wake up, I learn something new.
Well, you all can learn something new by subscribing to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's new newsletter called Unapologetically ATL. It's all about the people, the events, and the entertainment happening in Metro Atlanta that Black people might want to know about.
Like historically Black colleges and universities.
Atlanta's thriving arts scene.
And the city's growing neighborhoods.
Wherever you live, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what issues are important to you.
So subscribe today at www.ajc.com/unapologeticallyATL.
Only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.